Thank you, Sue, and good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We are now beginning the third matter that is scheduled for today's for oral argument. It's the matter of Beland versus Rylander. We are proceeding by Zoom this morning, as we already know from the technical glitches, but I'm glad to see both of you, and we'll remind you that the same rules apply that would apply if we were arguing in court today. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. We are making an audio recording of this session, and that is the only permitted recording of today's hearing. With that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you. May it please the court. Good morning, everyone. My name is Sarah Kite. I'm an attorney out of Grand Forks, North Dakota. I represent appellant Matthew Beland in these proceedings. We are here today on two issues that arise out of a November 4th, 2020 order imposing frivolous litigant restrictions and a May or March 24, 2021 order authorizing attorneys' fees over $10,000. So I'll start.
May I just ask you a question out of the bat? There's an attorney's fees component to the November 20 order also. Is that in dispute here, or simply the attorney's fees awarded in March of 2021?
Well, I mean, it's kind of confusing because the March 24, 2021 attorney's fees are exponentially raised because of prior attorney's fees. However, there were orders by this court on specifically what could be appealed. So I do think it's important to discuss the prior attorney's fees because I believe that it was kind of a building block as to how we ended up here. But I don't think that it was authorized to appeal prior attorney's fees.
Thank you.
So I guess I'll just start with the frivolous litigant order. Basically, it imposes frivolous litigant restrictions without actually finding appellant a frivolous litigant. And if you start at the beginning, the first thing that has to happen is the person has to be served and given a safe harbor provision of 21 days. That didn't happen here. In addition to that, even if he was served, he wasn't really given notice of what it was that they were requesting being withdrawn or corrected. And I do just want to point out that the timer is not going. There you go. So,
Thank you. I should
anyways,
have noted that.
that's all right. So, yeah, I just want to point out that I guess I don't think even today that respondent can state exactly what it was that Mr. Beland was supposed to correct or withdraw. And so then we have the issue of there was only two pending motions that Mr. Beland had before the court. Those were resolved. And
Okay,
if
let me stop you there. One of the and I wanted to also ask you this early on in your argument because it impacts the standard of review, which is important in this case, as always. You make an argument in your brief that the district court lacked jurisdiction or authority to entertain a Rule 901 motion because there was not a pending proceeding. I think you've basically told me, in fact, there was. The child custody matter was still pending. In fact, as I understand it, respondent had filed a motion seeking to modify child custody while, at about the same time that the Rule 9 and Rule 11 motion arose. Do you agree with that and agree that what we're looking for on the frivolous litigant issue is abuse of discretion?
No, I would disagree because at the time it was filed before the appellant had ever filed a motion, a counter motion to modify custody. So the only motions that were out there when the frivolous litigant motion was filed against appellant here was, I believe it was a motion to quash a subpoena and a motion to amend findings. Both of those had merit to them. And
But
even
you would
if
agree that there is an action or proceeding at the time respondent sought the frivolous litigant designation.
So there was an action or proceeding as far as, yes, his later counter motion to modify custody. But when I outlined the case law on that, it was you have to file a motion for a frivolous litigant determination and sanctions on a motion that's pending. So you have to give them notice. This is what you're supposed to correct. This is what you're supposed to withdraw. And then you give them the safe harbor provision. But the case law is very clear. When that motion, see, the problem here is we don't know what that motion is. We don't know what was supposed to be withdrawn. It would help if we knew that, but we don't. But if one of those motions that were there, let's say it was the motion to quash the subpoena or the motion to amend the findings, if it was one of those that was pending at the time, then the court loses its jurisdiction once it determines those motions. and moves on. So you can't determine the motion to amend findings and then later say, oh, that was frivolous. Now I'm going to impose frivolous litigant findings and restrictions. That's when the court loses its jurisdiction. That's when the action or proceeding or motion is no longer pending. And so I think it's completely irrelevant that there was a motion later filed by the appellate in this case that a counter motion to modify custody. And in fact, there obviously was a lot of things, facts between the parties as far as to why they were asking for those things. And they've ultimately settled on those things and basically maintained their status quo of joint legal and physical custody, which then should show you that there was merit to his counter motion. And so it really comes back to what is it? What was he supposed to withdraw? Was he given due process and notice and able to accommodate this request? But ultimately, the judge doesn't even make any determinations on what that was because there was no notice given there. And she decides to go through the analysis of the frivolous litigant sanctions. Well, first you have to find them frivolous, then you can go through the analysis on what the sanctions should be. I don't think that her analysis, which was just adopted by the attorney of the respondent here, I don't think that analysis gives this court enough to go with to review because it's not supported by the record. You can look at, okay, she says, whatever in factor A, B, C, or D, but it's not really supported by the record. Sure, there is a
So
long
can I
history.
let me yes let, and that's the question I guess I have. I mean, the district court, you would agree, I'm looking at the order. I mean, the district court does explain its reasoning. I know you argue that's conclusory, and I respect that argument. What I'm having difficulty, and I can't speak for my panel members, but the difficulty for me is on this extensive record to really assess whether that reasoning constitutes abuse of discretion. Where can you point me in the record? I mean, where would I go in the record to find abuse of discretion or clear error in the district court's reasoning? I'm really struggling with that.
Yeah, I had looked at that and it becomes very complicated. I'll give you a couple of examples. Number one, she talks about how a duplicative motion was filed. So there was some sort of pending motions on modifications of some of the parenting time provisions. And then Attorney Weber filed a motion for contempt against respondent. And the court says that that was duplicative. Well, I disagree because contempt has a different outcome than a modification of some sort of provision, right? But that's one of the things she uses to support her analysis in duplicative, already determined or already pending before the court. And I don't think that's appropriate because A, like I've already said, there are different outcomes that can come from those motions. But B, it was filed by an attorney, and so it should not be used against him here. Another example I can give you is she talks about filing for.
I'm going to stop you for a moment. We have a technical glitch on our end now, and so I'm going to ask the marshal to stop running the time for a bit until we get Judge Larkin back online. I apologize. Nope, we just took a break and now it looks like you're back in action.
Fabulous.
So.
I just so people know, I turned the camera off for a moment because I noticed my battery was almost dead. I did not know I was having a problem with my power cord, so I just needed a second to switch it. But I could hear, just didn't want you guys to see me rushing around. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. And Ms. Kite, you may continue.
Thank you. And another example I can give you is when the judge refers to Mr. Bielan filing harassment restraining orders, and she basically substantiates her imposition of frivolous litigant restrictions, claiming that those were without merit. Well, hindsight now, those it was the same judge who denied those harassment restraining orders. And so, in hindsight, now we now have this court of appeals saying that that was an abuse of discretion. So, one of the things that she said was that they didn't have merit. And in a separate filing order, she said that they were frivolous. So, she's kind of got an order that she abused her discretion on in a separate HRO case that she uses to substantiate making the same finding here. Some of the other things she says is that he's often been denied his motions or not prevailed very often and things like that. However, if you do look at the record will show things like, no, it was him who agreed to these things or stipulated to these things or asked for these things. So I don't believe the record supports even what she's saying. So,
But you can understand the difficulty of an appellate court trying to look at this extensive record and find that the district court is wrong when it says multiple motions have been brought and most of them appellant hasn't prevailed on. So I appreciate your efforts to clarify the important parts of the record for us.
yeah, absolutely. And which is why I point out that she did not give enough for this court to even be able to review. I mean, she should have been saying this order he was denied, this order lacked merit. But really here, I mean, the whole point of the restrictions, if she were even able to say he was given notice and she had jurisdiction and found frivolous on some thing that was pending before her, then it should licensed attorneys, which clearly the district court is not authorized to limit the licensure of licensed attorneys and their ability to practice law and file motions of that nature. And so the vagueness of the sanctions is also extremely concerning here. What is the fee? What is the amount? What is the process? And we've seen how that works when he has tried to do that and it simply doesn't. She simply says, you haven't followed the process without clarifying what the process is, even though he has followed the process as best as what is written here. So we do have a huge, huge problem, but I think it all goes back to what is the problem? What was frivolous? What was he told to fix? How could he have fixed it? How can we fix this going forward? This is supposed to be a very cautioned against way to proceed. We don't simply just shut the doors of the courthouse to people because we don't like them coming back before us as a judge, speaking from that perspective. And so
Well, I
that
think that might be a bit of a euphemism about what the judge was doing. I didn't read the decision to suggest that it was because, we don't like the client, the party coming before the judge. I think it was an overall assessment, albeit without precise identification of a win-loss record that didn't look too good for your client. That sort of like playing whack-a-mole. The issues keep coming up. He loses more than he wins, and it would appear, at least to the district court, perhaps, to believe that your client is just bringing issues before the court that are untimely, that are no longer at play, and that have no basis in law or fact. I
yeah,
think
and
that's the way the district court would characterize the decision, as opposed to just not liking your client coming before the court.
well, and I think it's very clear in the record. I mean, you don't even have to open up the orders, the motions, or anything like that. If you look at the record, I bet there were less than three times that he was the person who filed the motion. Everything was a responsive motion. And so I guess to me, that's very concerning when somebody's filing a responsive motion to say, we're going to shut the doors, we're going to make it more difficult for you to even respond. And that's what has happened even after this, saying you need to follow this process to even just respond to a motion. And so I guess I think that it was written maybe the way that you've characterized it. However, when you look at the record will clearly show that he's not bringing things untimely. He's not bringing things out of the blue. He's not bringing motions. He's actually just responding for the most part. There probably are a couple things in there, in particular child support, that he has proactively filed for review. But other than that, everything was on the responsive side. And so I see I only have a few minutes left. And so I just wanted to make sure I touch base on the attorney's fees award. And I think it's just very clear that it was brought for Under the rule that's basically attorney's fees can be awarded against a party if their conduct unnecessarily lengthens or increases the cost for the other party. Here, obviously, every party has a right to discovery. Mr. Beeland's attorney issued discovery. That attorney was me. There was another attorney, and I think that the court was concerned that there could be duplicative discovery. That didn't happen, and I could see if that was a concern.
Well, it seemed like it was, if I understood the court correctly, it wasn't just duplicative. It was the unusually extensive nature of the requests that were being made and not all tied to the issues that were presently before the court, perhaps regarding issues that had already been resolved by the court or that were in play in other proceedings, such as on appeal. Correct me if I'm wrong about how I'm interpreting the district court's decision.
I think that's somewhat fair. However, I think it was more of a concern that it overlapped into the custody issues and that my representation was only on non-custody issues at that time. And so the overlap, I think, was the concern and that there could be duplicative nature there. However, that didn't happen. And so I don't think we award attorney's fees on things that could happen. We award them on things that do happen. Also, he's clearly not the attorney, he's
Well,
the
it didn't
party.
happen because didn't the district court grant the motion to quash that discovery?
Well, I think it didn't happen because the parties settled and there was no trial. Like, there could have been more discovery. There would have been a discovery conference. That discovery at that time was quashed. However, then attorneys change, scope of attorneys change, and then the parties settled. So, I mean, at that time, certainly, but it could have perhaps been duplicative if another attorney had issued the same things later. But it did not. And really, the ultimate issue is he's the party. He's not the attorney. He doesn't know. He doesn't sign discovery. There's a reason attorneys sign discovery. So how do you sanction a party for that? He, as the party, has the right to the discovery. And whether it crosses over into a custody issue, he still has a right to that discovery for his custody issue. I mean, so I don't think that the district court really clarifies how and under what rule. Well, it does clarify. It clarifies that it's under the scope of when the party does the conduct, the party's conduct. Well, there's no allegation, no finding that there was any party conduct here that raised these
So just so I'm clear in
costs.
your argument, your position is that if the attorney engages in discovery or litigation that is onerous, the district court cannot impose sanctions on the client under the attorney's fee provision. That's if that's your argument, please clarify. And if it is, what's your most reliable authority for that proposition?
Well, I may have to get back to you on the authority as I only have 35 seconds here. But yes, under the rule itself that she uses under 518, it's only for the party's conduct. I do believe there are discovery sanctions and discovery rules that could authorize attorney's fees against an attorney for issuing improper discovery in that nature. But that's not what happened here. She uses the rule under the family law 518. 1-4 or something like that. That says a party's conduct can they it, when it increases costs in litigation can be the basis for attorney's fees against that party.
Well, I hope that during your time before a rebuttal, you have an opportunity to find the case law or the authority that supports that proposition.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you may proceed. You are on mute.
Sorry, I was so eager to begin my argument. I forgot to unmute myself. May it please the court, opposing counsel. It's an honor to appear here before you all. My name is Sean McNamara. I'm an attorney out of Fargo, North Dakota, with ABST Law, appearing for the respondent in this matter. I'll jump right into the argument and give kind of a roadmap about our argument and position, but it's very laid out in our brief.
May I
First,
start with one question just on the factual background? Was there a pending motion that appellant had brought that was the genesis of the frivolous litigant motion? And if so, what was it?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the answer to that question is yes. The specifics of that question and digging into the minutiae of that, I can't quite exactly speak to that one specific motion being. I think part of the reason for that being too with these frivolous litigant determinations, I think that more commonly to say that there's one specific motion that triggers this is not really the standard that frivolous litigants, and at least in my experience and at least how the law recognizes that, is that typically with these frivolous litigant determinations, it's numerous motions, things for the court to point to. So typically, if it was one motion, you know, we probably wouldn't be here because, you know, one motion isn't what the court would be determinative of frivolous. Well, rather what we have here is a court summarily saying, you know, there's so many motions, there's so many pleadings, there's so many things that summarily the district court is put in a position where it can't just say this one motion right here. It's the cumulative nature of these proceedings, and the court must, you know, address summarily these proceedings in that way. You know, to address every single specific thing, you know, certainly puts the district court in quite the predicament, I would think, especially with these, you know, looking at just this particular issue with the frivolous litigant piece. So I think obviously that doesn't answer your question, but I think that that helps kind of explain why, you know, we may summarily look at some of these criteria by the district court. And that moves into obviously the court's analysis in this case. So I believe part of the argument is that, you know, looking at the specifics, well, this is a factorial analysis. There's eight different criteria, with that eighth piece of criteria being kind of a catch-all factor. In this particular case, the court addressed seven criteria, found that six criteria applied, supported that criteria with reasoning, with facts, and then the one piece of criteria, I believe, factor D, it said did not apply. And then the court also did not apply the catch-all last factor. So to say that the court did not provide any analysis on this, or that the court cannot point to anything, is just absurd in this case. Now I'll move on into what exactly that all means in this case. And I think there's an important point of clarification too. One piece about that is this, somehow that this is not under an abuse of discretion standard, that the court somehow wasn't able to make this determination at this point. If you look back at that November 4th, 2020 order, there are numerous motions pending between these parties. The court clearly has jurisdiction to issue this type of order at this point. And this was an issue that was briefed upon rebuttal. An issue that, quite frankly, I don't think should be before this court, because I think it's crystal clear that the court does have the authority at this time in the proceeding to issue this type of order on the frivolous litigation determinant. And I think that's apparent from the order itself and the case law supporting those arguments. So that would be my rebuttal to those arguments that were raised in the first part of the appellee's argument.
How do you respond to counsel's argument that, look, if you look at the record as a whole, and I know you've suggested that the district court was appropriate in kind of looking at the thing in a summary fashion, but, you know, my review of the record suggests that, you know, that Ms. Kite's representation, that many of her clients' requests for relief or arguments, issues that were raised to the district court that apparently support at least some of the analysis in terms of the frivolous litigation, or come when he's responding to your client's motions. Doesn't that make a difference?
You know, Your Honor, I think that there's definitely some weight given to that, I would think. And I think that obviously the district court was in the best position to give weight and analysis to that. And I think, you know, clearly the district court was in the position to assess what type of motions were being made and who was making them. The district court didn't find that my client was making, motions that weren't furthering the proceedings or anything like that. So obviously there's going to be motions made by both parties. So, I mean, the fact that there was responsive motions made, I think, is kind of a separate issue. Of course, there's going to be parties making motions and responding to motions. I think that the court definitely focused in more on the court, on the petitioner making motions, and the the Rule 9 relief is tailored to that too. If you look at the final page discussing the Rule 9 relief, it's on page 21 of the order. The petitioner shall serve and file a summary of his specific motions along with a list of purported documents. And those apply to the motions that he's making or the motions that he's bringing. So it's tailored down to that specific motion, but also has to categorically list the motions that are all pending because they're so numerous. The district court also more narrowly tailored it to make it not apply retroactively to motions that were already pending. So there was some, the district court didn't just blanket, you know, blanket apply these restrictions retroactively. The district court, you know, looked at this and applied it to motions going forward as well. So none of those, the court's ruling didn't affect his already pending motions or his responsive motions to that matter. So I hope that helps explain a little bit to your question. Now, I do want to use a lot of my time now to focus on the second argument. The second argument being, or the second issue rather, between the parties, which is whether the district court erred in awarding conduct-based attorney's fees. Now, the district court at length, and I think before I begin my argument, I think it's important to note that this case presents a unique set of facts. Especially in terms of an attorney-client relationship. Not only is this a case where the petitioner is represented by his spouse, but also it's a case where the petitioner was represented by his spouse and another party. So obviously there are some issues when your spouse is your attorney that creates, you know, your spouse is a potential character witness to, you know, many things going on. So that right there just creates a huge potential for conflict of interest, clearly.
How does that bear on the attorney's fees question?
So thank you for that question, Your Honor. So how that bears on the attorney's fees question is when you have, and the conduct exactly of this attorney right now is how so? So when one attorney, when there's a kind of a two-headed monster of an attorney, if one of those heads begins going down a road of discovery, which can implicate those child issues, child custody issues of which she could be a potential witness for, then that's where the possibility for that duplication becomes, because that second attorney is necessary to, you know, essentially command that ship. And anything that's done by that other attorney, you know, is essentially, can't be, you know, she can't be creating, you know, fact and be an attorney. So anything that she does has to be redone. And that's highlighted by the court's order. So there was already discovery in this case that, you know, an attorney, our attorney, would have to review. But then if it's done by the other attorney, they're going to have to redo it again. That's a clear duplication. And so that's essentially what the district court was reviewing in this case. Well, not only that, but the district court also analyzed in this case that there was a unwillingness to facilitate that discovery in light of these conflict of interests. So that also created a kind of untenable situation between the attorneys engaging in discovery in this, adding to complication, adding to confusion, and adding to the expense of the parties. Now, That's also noted, is that there's a failure to cooperate in this unique situation.
Can you address Ms. Kite's argument that conduct of the attorney is distinguished from conduct of the party as it regards conduct-based attorney's fees under the statute?
Right, Your Honor. And that was an issue that was not briefed before me. It's an issue that I'm, you know, now hearing the first time at, you know, 35 minutes into an appellate argument. And my understanding is I don't want to give the court wrong information or my opinion. I just, I'm not prepared for that argument, Your Honor.
But do you think that the district court here was sanctioning the appellant for his lawyer's conduct?
Well, no, Your Honor. I mean, I guess that's a, I don't believe so. I think that, I guess I'm not sure of that question. Yeah, Your Honor, I would have to look into that argument before I would feel confident in giving this court a response on that.
Well, the order directs the appellant to pay the fees, not the lawyer to pay the fees. But under the case law with respect to conduct-based attorney's fees, does the law permit that fees to be awarded under that provision based on conduct of represented parties in litigation?
I have not reviewed the case law relevant to that. And just glancing over my case law now that I've cited within my brief, I don't believe it addresses that issue directly. I also believe that I think the argument that was made and that was briefed to this court was that the award of fees in and of itself was not permitted. This specific argument that the fees were assessed incorrectly against party or attorney was not briefed and was not the issue before this court. So as that was not the issue presented to for my response, that is not an issue that I've briefed. I don't have the proper research and things like that before me at this time, Your Honor. With that, I would submit that this court affirm the district court's November 4th, 2020 order and March 24th, 2021 order. And I will conclude my argument if there are no further questions.
I see no further questions. Thank you. Ms. Kite, you will have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. So to respond to the legal question about whether or not the court can impose attorney's fees against a party for the conduct of their attorney, on page 12 of my initial brief, right in the middle there, I quoted the so it starts out, the court has repeatedly held that, and then this is where I quote, absent evidence regarding the level of a represented party's involvement in the conduct that gave rise to the imposition of sanctions, represented party could not be held accountable and sanctioned. And then that is Murren versus Mosher, Minnesota Court of Appeals, March 23rd, 2010. And there was a lot of case law cited in there as well. And I also do believe that that was more in line with, there may have been some of those cases we're talking about Rule 11 sanctions and discovery sanctions, but I believe that all in all, it applies across the board. So there may be a time where a party could be sanctioned if it was their conduct as well. And that's the point. A party is sanctioned for the attorney's fees for their conduct that increased the attorney's fees and length of the proceeding for the other party. And so I believe there could be a situation, but again, it goes back to the plain language of the statute, a party's conduct. And so we don't have any evidence. We don't have any findings of a party's conduct. And I'm not going to waste this court's time on what's wrong with the findings of the district court. I mean, you could look at all the emails that talk about, you know, myself and the other attorney agreeing to these depositions, agreeing to a discovery conference, but I didn't want to agree to a increasing the length of the proceedings. But that's not really what's before this court. What's before this court is that it's not the party's conduct. And I know Mr. McNamara talked about how, you know, that there was different attorneys here. I am the one who retained the second attorney. We worked well together. But again, that goes back to my point of, you know, it's the party's right to the discovery. It's not for the judge to speculate how there could be problems in the future. I mean, the district court.
It's the party's right to relevant discovery. And isn't the award here premised on the fact that the discovery went far beyond the issues of the, I think, Rule 9 and 11 motions pending against the respondent? I mean, what, as I read the order, that's what that was about.
That's actually a really great question that we haven't talked about very much. And the district court was saying how it wasn't relevant to the Rule 9 and 11 motions, and it crossed over into the custody issues, right? And then if you look at the record here, there are several orders, but there's orders down the line that actually say they are so intertwined. And I believe that's probably
we don't look at orders that are down the line. Again, where in the record would we go looking back, right? Because we're not looking forward. We have this appeal from the November 20th order and the March 21st order. So what happens after that is not within the scope of our review. Where in the record would we look to say this discovery that was propounded on behalf of the appellant was rational, was related, was not harassing, and should not support an award of conduct-based fees?
Well, even in the same order, she's talking about it's not relevant to Rule 9 and 11. However, at the same time, she's saying it crosses over discovery, but it's still relevant to that party, the appellant here, as far as motions to modify custody. I mean, that's still relevant to him. The district court's analysis of this was based on the scope of representation for the attorney she's looking at, which she's not even privy to. She doesn't know what the scope of representation is above and beyond what's happening in the courtroom, the scope of representation for our oral arguments and things of that nature. She doesn't necessarily get to know what the scope of representation is outside of that. And so, but that's her framing, her view, right, is that it went beyond the scope of the Rule 9-11 per the attorney's signature on there. Okay, so that seems like a rather detailed factual, or rather detailed legal analysis that a party, not an attorney, could not know. Because, of course, to that party, all of that is relevant to him because he has a custody modification motion. How could he possibly know, or what was his conduct? But at the end of the day, there is no findings, no evidence, no allegations that his conduct related to any of this. And on top of that, the service of the affidavit and motion for attorney's fees wasn't even served timely. It was after the fact. There was no way that he could respond. But $10,000 plus to not respond to discovery seems a bit out of touch and out of line when they're even under the sanctions rules, you can't authorize that amount of attorney's fees without a motion to compel. And there was no motion to compel here. And I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. That is the last matter on our calendar for oral argument today, so we are in recess. Thank you.